We are in the book of Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 12. We started it last week, and we're picking up this week in verses 9 through 14. It's always helpful to remember what we talked about last week. And what we talked about last week was, remember, Jesus and his disciples were passing through the grain field, and the disciples were plucking the heads of grain and rubbing them in their hands, and they were eating the fruit out of it. And the Pharisees saw them doing this, and they came to them, and they charged them. They actually came to Jesus. The interesting thing is Jesus wasn't doing this. The disciples were. They didn't come and confront Jesus or confront them. They came and they confronted Jesus with it. So you know the aim of it really was not to, you know, encourage his disciples to do what's supposed to be done in their mind on the Sabbath day. Obviously, it was a direct attack against their leader, Jesus. What we're going to read today is a continuation of that. The conversation hasn't stopped yet. What it does now, however, it moves location. It moves from the grain field now into one of the Jewish synagogues. So let's read verses 9 through 14 in chapter 12 of Matthew. And departing from there, he went into their synagogue, and behold, there was a man with a withered hand, and they questioned him, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" in order that they might accuse him. And he said to them, "What man shall there be among you who shall have one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take hold of it and lift it out? Or how much more value of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? So then it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." And he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched out his hand, and it was restored to normal like the other. But the Pharisees went out and counseled together against him as to how they might destroy him. One of the most interesting things about this is that the synagogues were the church of the Pharisees. In other words, he, in essence, Jesus, in going where he went into their very house. And I would imagine they probably would have had a lot more confidence, a lot more boldness in that setting than maybe they did out in the grain field, because this is their domain. This is where they teach. This is where their word has great bearing as it's applied to the people in the congregation, because you need to understand that synagogues were kind of like churches, okay? Where they came from, you may not realize this, because the focus of the worship in Israel was always on the temple, right? But then along came that Babylonian captivity, and they didn't have a temple to go to. They were in a foreign land, and they certainly didn't want to go to the temple for the pagan gods there. And this is really where the idea of synagogues began to develop, was during that Babylonian captivity. But you need to understand that the synagogues really were more centers of learning and teaching. The temple, on the other hand, had a much greater focus on worship. Well, why did Jesus go to the synagogue? Well, Luke helps us here. It really is interesting. There are a lot of things, a lot of details you get from other gospels that help you to understand a particular one a little bit better, just from little things that they say. And one of them is this, is from chapter 4 in Luke. This is when Jesus goes to Nazareth. It says he came to Nazareth where he had been brought up, and as was his custom, he entered the synagogue on the Sabbath day. So my whole thing here, guys, is this is exactly where we expected Jesus to go on the Sabbath day. It was his custom to do it. So he wasn't going there to fight some battle. He wasn't going there to confront these Pharisees or anything like that. He was going there to worship God as he did every Sabbath day. Jesus was a churchgoer. Does that surprise anybody? It really shouldn't. A man with a withered hand enters the synagogue. We just assume that he's coming there for his regular Sabbath worship. I would imagine he was probably there every Sabbath day and probably went there that day without expecting anything phenomenal happening. We don't have any reason to believe that he went there specifically because he knew Jesus was going to be there and he wanted Jesus to heal him. We don't have any reason to believe that. There's no detail of that in the Gospels at all. It sounds like this just happened to be a guy who had a withered hand who showed up for what he normally showed up for on Saturdays. The Pharisees bring attention, Jesus' attention, upon this guy with a withered hand. You need to understand that according to rabbinic law, not according to the scriptures, but according to the rabbi's interpretation of the scriptures, it was unlawful for anyone to be attended to medically on the Sabbath day unless their life was in jeopardy. So the only way that they were supposed to, if you cut your hand a little bit and you weren't going to die from it, you had to wait until the next day to have it mended or taken care of. So the only exception was if someone was dying, could they administer medical help on the Sabbath day. Obviously, having a withered hand is not something that is so pressing he's going to die if it's put off to some other time, right? And I would imagine that this man has had his hand looked at many, many times already, and no one's ever been able to do anything about fixing it. You may not realize it, but there are other extra-biblical documents. In other words, there are other writings that we have today, copies of those things that we have today, that are not in the Scriptures, they're not included in the New Testament, but we still have them. And sometimes we find some details there because this particular instance is actually mentioned in one of those, and in that particular context or in that particular scroll, this man is referred to as being a stonemason. In other words, he was one of those guys with a hammer and a chisel who cut out stones from big chunks of stone to make them smaller chunks of stone for buildings, for using for foundation stones and things along those lines. It really fascinates the mess out of me how these people were ever able to do what they did in the old days with just a, and usually you're talking about copper. They didn't have steel so much in those harder, stronger kind of metals that you and I are used to. Very often they were using crude copper tools and things like that. How in the world they were ever able to chisel out perfect cubes of rock. And let me tell you, I've been to the Parthenon. And you look at those rocks, those stones there on the steps going up and all that have been there now for thousands of years, you can hardly perceive there's a seam between some of them. They are so smooth, they are so flat, we would have a hard time replicating it today with all the machinery that we have. People spent their life doing things like that. How long do you think it would take somebody to cut out a stone the size of this podium using a hammer and chisel? And I'm sure they had some kinds of primitive saws too. A stonemason. Now, and we don't know this either, but there's a good chance that his hand probably or possibly was injured as he was conducting his profession. He could have smashed it with a hammer. Could have gotten caught between a big rock and another rock. We don't know how his hand was withered, but there's some reason here to think, you know what, maybe he was doing what he normally did when his hand was injured. Notice here that the Pharisees really don't have any compassion for the guy. I mean, you don't have any sense that they're sensitive to his condition or anything like that. They just see this man as an opportunity for them to try to trap Jesus, to use him to trap Jesus. They weren't interested in seeing this man's hand healed. That was the furthest thing from their mind. And remember this, that more than likely, they may not have seen Jesus do healings up to this point, some of these Pharisees, but they had heard about it, because let me tell you, he was doing a lot of it, and it was spreading across the countryside like wildfire. We've seen that in the early chapters of Matthew. Jesus healed this, and Jesus healed this leper, and he healed this woman that was hemorrhaging, and he raised this little girl from the dead, and all kinds of miraculous things Jesus is doing. And we have to understand, people, if something like that was going on here, do you think people would be talking about it? Yeah, it would spread like wildfire. And so it has. Their whole reason for this was to be able to accuse Jesus, to find some fault with him. That was their whole intention from day one. We see this over and over again. When the Pharisees first appear in the ministry of Jesus, it's the same thing. They do their best to try to trap him time after time after time after time, and they will be doing it up to the just a few days before, and even on the day before he's crucified. Unrelenting attack, continually, constantly. And you're going to find that they use all kinds of means and mechanisms to try to accomplish their end. And the thing about it is this, guys, is every one of their attempts fails. Every single one of them fails. Have you ever been falsely accused of anything? I would imagine most of us have. Right? Times maybe when you were a kid, did your parents ever discipline you when you didn't really do anything wrong? They were convinced that you did. They thought you did. Something happened. They just knew it was you, and they punished you. But you know in your heart that it wasn't you. You didn't do it. You didn't tell that lie. You didn't steal this, and you didn't do this, that, or the other. We've all been falsely accused of things at times. As a Christian, my friends, you will be. There will be people that come into your life. They may be friends. They may be neighbors. Sadly, sometimes they might even be church people that will accuse you of things that are false. Why is that true? It's true because sin is still in us. Churches are not perfect. Churches have sinful people in them. And whenever they're sinful people, at least on occasion, things like being accusing folks of wrongdoing falsely is going to happen. You see, it's not an issue if it happens. The issue is it will happen. It will. I think sometimes people believe there's perfect churches somewhere, that there's one of them out there where there's never any conflict, there's never any false accusations brought against people and things like that. That church, my friends, does not exist in this world. It exists in heaven right now, but it doesn't exist in this world. So the issue is not, will things like this come along? The issue is, what will you do when they do? Will they be dealt with in the way, the manner in which Jesus tells us to deal with them? And let me tell you, whenever there's difficulty, there's conflict, the very first thing that every one of us needs to do is to consider our own part in the whole matter. That's not what we typically do. What we typically do is this, is we typically look around and we point fingers at everybody else and we start talking to everybody else and we try to build our camp on our side. Always consider first, before you even open your mouth, what has been my part. And if you can't see anything, I guarantee there is something there. You need to understand that. Everybody that's involved in every situation, there are no innocent people. Every person involved in it has done something bad. Because that's what sin does. And sin will divide us if we let it do that. He said to them, what man shall there be among you who shall have one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out? Jesus is always about practical application. Remember that the whole thing that took place in the grain field was applying what he was taught just immediately before that, given a practical application of exactly the principles of the things that he would have been teaching before. He's continuing to do the same thing. You and I probably don't know much about sheep. Don't see too many sheep in Florida. You will see one every now and then. I've never been around sheep in my whole lifetime other than maybe in a petting zoo when I was a little kid or when we took our kids to a petting zoo. But sheep were a very common thing. It was probably, if you walked down the road on the Sabbath day, which you wouldn't do because they weren't allowed to do that, but if you had done something like that, you probably would have seen a lot of sheep out in the fields. Sheep are used all over the Bible. More often than not, they're used to kind of be an analogy of what people are like. We all know what it means to have animals that are dependent upon us, right? Most of us do. Some people don't have any pets. They've never had any pets. They don't want to have any pets, and that's fine if that's you. But the vast majority of us, at least at one time, if not today, we've had the responsibility of looking after the needs of an animal, right? Whether it be a cat or a dog or cows or sheep or whatever kind of animal. Every one of us knows something about that. When we take them into our care, we accept responsibility for them. The point Jesus is making here is this. Is there always exceptions? And we talked about that last week. There's always exceptions to what sometimes seem to be very hard, fast rules and regulations. And he's saying here, what would you do? What would you do if you found a sheep, one of your sheep, had fallen into a pit on the Sabbath day? Would you just leave it there? You'll just say, sheep, I'd love to get you out, but it's a Sabbath day, and if I lift down there and grab you and pull you out, then I'm working and I'll be breaking the Sabbath day. Just hang on and I'll be back in the morning. See, guys, this is what legalists do. They drive things to this point. The legalist would say that. That's what God's law teaches, that there are no exceptions to it. There's no practical application that falls outside the realm of God saying something black and white and us applying it black and white. Just remember this, Jesus wrote God's law. So if anybody knows what God's law says and what the intention of God's law is, it's him. It's ridiculous. These people are going to him, explaining to him what he said and what he meant when he said it. Lori and I were watching a movie a couple of weeks ago, and there was a scene. There was a family wedding, and it was a farm family, and the guy and the gal, it wasn't the wedding couple, but Tom Selleck and some lady that he had been married to at one time. Wasn't married, they weren't married. Anyways, a farm deal, and they're going to the wedding, and they're driving down the road, and they pass one of his cows that is in a mud hole next to the road that's stuck in there. And so they stop, he hands her his coat and all that, she goes on to the wedding, and he gets down in the mud with a cow. I would imagine that kind of stuff happens all the time on farms. I mean, you can't say cow, sorry, I'll be back after the wedding. I mean, there are things that really sometimes, and we need to understand things like, even things like this come by God's hand. Now, I will say this. Today, it seems like there's some people that seem to care more about animals than they care about people. I'm telling you, there's some people I know that have pets. They treat them better than most kids get treated. mean, they really do. And don't get me wrong. We need to be very compassionate to animals. But let me tell you, there are limits. And one of the limits is this, is people always take precedent over animals. In other words, if you're going to save the life of something, you know, there's a car coming and there's a dog in the road and there's a person in the road, you're supposed to get the person out of the road first. Always. You understand that? The reason for that is this, is one of the big things about people that's different than every other creature is that we are made in God's image. Now, we have secular humanism out there that would tell you that people really are just, they're just living things like everything else, and that's the end of the story. But what I want to tell you this morning is this, is you're the only creature that is described in the Bible as being made in God's image. That makes you very, very important. It sets you apart from the rest of creation. I used to work for a vet. Actually, I spent 3 years trying to get into vet school years ago. Came within two people the second year. But then I started falling back, so I finally had to give up on one of my dreams. So I did that. But I spent a lot of time with, you know, people. They bring their dog in or they bring their cat in, and obviously, you know, the time is coming very soon when the death is going to fall upon them. And very often there are little kids there, and everybody's crying, and you know, you're getting ready to euthanize the dog, and the family's in there, and they're gathered around saying their goodbyes and all of that. There's a place for that kind of thing. But it is a scary thing when we take that and we make that like the center, the focus of all things. Sometimes, let me tell you, I wonder if people would choose their pet over a person. Jesus did not come to live, to die and be resurrected for the salvation of pets. He came to live and die and be resurrected for sinners, people sinners like you. And like me, we were, with no doubt about it, his greatest priority. Secular humanists would have you believe that they are the ones that really care about life. But I'm telling you this morning that they are wrong. If they think they care more about people's lives than we do. He said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out and it was restored to normal like the other. No surgery, no medication. Jesus didn't even touch him. Stretch out your hand. Well, as we said before, there's good reason for us to believe that man came there that day and having his hand restored before he left church was not even on the radar. The interesting thing is when Jesus says this to him, he does exactly what Jesus tells him to do, right? Stretch out your hand, and the man stretches out his hand. Do you see that's an act of faith? Could he have refused? Could he have just sat down? Could he have just left? He obeys the master. You see, the legalistic Pharisees had lost a good chunk of what the Sabbath day has to do with. It has to do with being good. It has to do with doing good things. Remember the little bracelets and things that were going around a few years ago? And they said on them, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Remember those? You ever think about those? Do you ever think when you find yourself in a particular situation, is the first thing that comes to your mind, well, what would Jesus do if he was here? It should. It really ought to, because we need to understand this, that everything Jesus ever did was good. He never did a bad thing, ever. And if he ever did, then you and I don't have a Savior. Jesus was all about doing good. God's good. It's the only thing he ever did was good. But let me tell you something. Passing by someone in distress on your way to church because you don't want to be late for services, it's not good. We may think when we do things like that our heart really is in the right place, but what Jesus is saying here is really isn't. How many of us after the worship service will stop somewhere on the way and eat at a restaurant? You know anybody that waiters or waitresses in a restaurant? You know anybody like that? I've known a few. Our son Stephen's done it. And let me tell you something. Most of those people dread church getting out on Sunday. And what they will tell you is that the church people are the least courteous, they're the most demanding, and they give the lowest tips. They don't look forward to church getting out on Sunday at all, most of them. Dave's over here, he's still where he knows that. It's true. Let me tell you guys, if it is true, that's not good either. If we're able to sit here this morning and talk about Jesus and all he's done and all the good he's done, and then we can turn around and do something like that, then we've wasted our time being here. We didn't learn a single thing. There's a rule that we need to apply, guys, and that is this, is that we will err. It's not a question of will we err. The fact of the matter is we will err. We will make errors. We will do things wrongly. But let me tell you something. We always need to err on the side of grace. In other words, if we don't have all the answers to all of our questions, we need to assume not the worst, but the very best until we have all of our eggs in the carton. Err on the side of grace. You see, it's far better to be called wrong when you're actually right than it is to be convinced you're right when you're actually wrong. The Pharisees went out and counseled together against him as to how they might destroy him. Jesus had just healed this guy with a withered hand. Do you think any of them could do that? Any of those Pharisees could do that? Remember Nicodemus in John chapter 3. He comes to Jesus, and one of the first things he says is, we know, he says, no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with you. I mean, the miracles were an absolute validation of the reality of who Christ was and the fact that he was sent by God to do what he was doing. If that weren't true, he couldn't do it. See, things like that will do one of two things when it comes to people. Either it will soften their heart or it will harden their heart. These guys, it hardens their heart. It just strengthens their resolve to be done with this guy. Example of just how close people can come to Jesus and yet turn away from him and deny his rightful place and walk away. Well, let me tell you guys, the scriptures teaches this, that people like that, that one of these days they will experience the sheer terror of falling into the hands of the living God. Hebrews 10:31. People whose motivation is selfish ambition. People who have a desire to exalt themselves and they like being over other people. People like the Pharisees, the rabbis, who are convinced that they speak for God, but the evidence around them indicates that they do everything else. They admonish men to keep their own created rules. They determine what is right and what is wrong to do on the Sabbath, or as we would call it, the Lord's Day. Who in the world does this Jesus fellow think he is, coming in to our synagogue and trying to teach us? We are the teachers. We are the teachers of Israel. Who does this person think he is? Well, we know who he is. And he knows who he is. He's the Lord of the Sabbath, in the grain field, and in the synagogue, and anywhere else he wants to go. Not only on the Sabbath, not only on the Lord's Day, but every day. All power in heaven and earth rests in his very hands. He is the King of kings. He is the Lord of lords. He is the true and living God. He is the one God. He is the righteous God. He is the holy God. He's the perfect being. He's the great I am. He's the ruler of all creation. And he took upon himself the flesh of a man and came into this world to save us from the legalists, and more importantly, to save us from ourselves. We're going to administer the Lord's Supper this morning. Guys, this is what it's all about. And this is to remind us of a lot of things. One of those is just how grievous and how great our sin is against God. It required his son to come to do this. Nothing else would have worked. And if we were just talking about Lloyd May, if Jesus came to the world to save Lloyd May and Lloyd May only, Jesus still would have had to come into the world to save Lloyd May. It's about the grievousness of our sin, but it's also about the greatness of the love of God. There are people who want to charge God with all kinds of things. How many times have you heard people say, well, how come if there's a God, there's evil in the world? Do you understand? God didn't bring the evil into the world. People brought the evil into the world. And oh, by the way, he's the only one that has sent his very son to live and die and be resurrected for those people. That's what it's all about. Take just a minute. and prepare your heart. I just want to say this before we do this. If you're visiting with us this day, the table is not for everybody. Okay, and what I mean by that is for sinners. It's for people who have, you know, they're convicted of their sin. They know they've wronged God. They believe in God, first of all. They know they've wronged that God. And they know that legalism will not get them to heaven. It's the legalism they tried to practice their whole lifetime by being good enough according to their own standard or somebody else's standard. It's people who have been broken by their sin, who understand they can't save themselves. We're trusting Jesus to do that for them. If you're one of those people, then we want to invite you to partake. And let me say this, if you're not, don't. And don't feel bad about it. In other words, we're not doing this to kind of force people to do this. If you don't want to be a part of it, then don't be a part of it, please. And no one's going to think the less of anybody.